This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
I'm Maya Lau, and this is Other People's Pockets. Today, I'm bringing you something different at this time of year where we're reflecting on our lives and the people we love. We're honoring a member of the Other People's Pockets family, Carmen Gonzalez, who tragically died this past August at the age of 24. Carmen was guest number 4 on this show, sharing how she handled her finances as a journalist and undocumented immigrant in Los Angeles. What you'll hear next is a montage of voices of people who knew and loved Carmen, followed by a rerun of her episode on Other People's Pockets. Thank you to my husband, Jesse Hardman, for helping put this episode together and for introducing me to Carmen. Carmen, if you're anywhere out there listening, we love you. You're a badass, and we miss you.
Bienvenidos to the last Radio Pulso of 2018, the Boyle Heights Beat podcast. Hey, y'all, it's the one and only Carmen Gonzalez and your girl Jackie Ramirez. ¿Qué onda, Jackie?
Hey, Carmen, it feels nice to be back. We want our audience to know that we're...
My name's Alex Medina, and I met Carmen Gonzalez through various LGBT organizations working with youth. We were both a part of the local newspaper called Boyle Heights Beat, and that's where we'd become a lot closer as friends, as people, and just in general. And it's here where I really got to know her. She was such a funny person who was so mindful of others, and she'd always make sure we were being considerate in our reporting. She'd always make sure that the organization stayed true to what made it so special. And even through really tough situations in her own life and at work, she stayed strong, and we'd work through things. If she were still here today, I'd want to let her know how much I really valued her as a friend. I'd want to listen through Taylor's next album with her and Jackie, like we did with the last one. And I'd want us all to go out one more time. I'd want us to go and rant one more time. Yeah. And I'd want more than anything in the world just to tell her goodbye.
My name is Carmen, and I'm here to represent. These days, the cards are kind of stacked against me. I'm queer, Latinx, and undocumented. The truth is, I barely graduated from high school last month, and I'm terrified of what's next. I have so many questions about growing up, like how financial aid works for an undocumented 18-year-old. But that ain't gonna stop me from contributing to the conversation.
It's all about Carmen G.
I'm taking advice from my favorite high school teacher, Ginger.
Be unapologetic about having to get yours.
I'm really hoping she's right, because I'm here to get it.
My name's Paulina Velasco. I met Carmen when I was working at a public radio station on a pilot. It was for a podcast about Latinx culture and conversations with a young, queer, undocumented Angelino as the host. And that was Carmen. Honestly, the whole idea was kind of a vehicle for Carmen's kindness, her wit, and her sharp takes. I was a huge fan immediately. The show wasn't greenlit. We were told it was too niche. But Carmen shrugged it off with her signature humor. And she and I would message each other every so often to check in about our experiences with journalism and mainstream media telling us our storytelling about Latinos was too niche. But every time we'd check in, we also remind each other that they were wrong. Our stories matter. Carmen, every time I would think about reaching out to you, I'd remember that by your example, you were always challenging me to stick with journalism, but also demand more of our profession. Always reminding me to be really proud of our identities and our communities. I'm gonna keep striving to live up to your example, Carmen. Miss you.
Hi, Carmen. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Hello. Thank you for having me back.
So tell me about the scene at your school, Mendez High School, where you've reported that 10% of students showed up yesterday.
Yeah, I was on the picket line with the teachers when they announced that 106 students out of 1,045 students.
My name is Andrea Galdames, and I know Carmen through Boyle Heights Beat. We met back in 2017, I think 2017, 2016. I think Carmen was one of the only people that I truly felt comfortable with. I could be funny, I could be dumb, I could do whatever it is, and she would definitely tell me I'm dumb. And, you know, she'd be like, that was dumb and stupid. But she did it with a sense of love and caring. It wasn't from judgment. I think I learned a lot about resilience from Carmen. She is someone that went through a lot of things, and, you know, her resilience and her fight, right? She was able to fight things, and I truly admire her, and I definitely miss her. And, you know, as I was sitting at her funeral, I took my phone out and I looked for her name and I started texting her. And I was like, why are you texting her? Like, she's not going to read this anymore. But in my text, I was saying, Carmen, like, if you would see that amount of people that showed up, if you could just see how much you were loved. But unfortunately, that's not possible, you know? So if I could see Carmen again or talk to her, I would give her a big hug. And I would tell her that she was such a great friend to me and that I miss her.
Hey, Carmen, can you list all the ways that you communicated with people this week?
Okay, let's see. It's a long list. I texted folks, used Facebook Messenger, used Instagram, Snapchat, WhatsApp. I even used email to talk to some folks. Also, this morning just sent money to mom, and I left her a little message through the Venmo app. She bought me Starbucks this morning. Most importantly, you forced me to learn how to write a letter. So I also wrote a letter.
How'd that go?
That last voice you heard there is my husband, Jesse Hardman. Jesse is how I met Carmen, and he met Carmen when he was a journalism mentor at the Boyle Heights Beat in Los Angeles. In more recent years, he was her collaborator, and they made a podcast together called Analog. Jesse, what's the main thing that you'll remember about Carmen?
She's one of the few people I've ever met that made me equally laugh and kind of stop and think about my perspective on things. Like, there was this incredible kind of balance with her of not taking the world too seriously and at the same time really thinking through your belief system and how you operated in the world. And I really relied on her, to kind of check some of my assumptions about the world and also to remember to laugh at myself.
Yeah, and you guys really went from something where you were her mentor, but to really being friends and also being co-creators on something.
From the minute I met Carmen, we were kind of having a longer conversation again, you know, where she was laughing at me, forcing me to think a little bit harder about certain things, but also listening to me and picking up some things here and there. I've been thinking since Carmen died a lot about, you know, the last decade or so of what's been going on in the world and her life and the city she lived in. And like, it's just so much. I think about, like, you know, her status and being undocumented and navigating that, navigating being a first generation immigrant and parents who, you know, had high expectations and wanted her to go to college, which she did. COVID, you know, starting college from home, where your parents live, and kind of having to, when she did go to classes, you know, take a 2-hour metro ride in LA to Santa Monica. And more recently, what's been going on in LA with immigration raids and dealing with friends and family whose status is still compromised. That's a lot of pressure. And I just, like, I can't imagine what that must have felt like inside and physically and mentally. And I'm so sad that she had to deal with all of that.
let's listen back to the interview I did with Carmen on Other People's Pockets in 2023.
A lot of Black feminists kind of took me under their wings and really taught me, like, concepts of community care. And there was also this idea, which I had already seen with my dad, you know, this idea of, like, until the most oppressed group is free, no one else will be free.
What does it look like to have a job where you can only get paid in gift cards? My guest today is Carmen Gonzalez, an undergrad at Cal State University Long Beach who's been undocumented for most of her life in the U.S.
I'm Carmen Gonzalez. I'm a college student, journalist, and the proud co-host of a podcast called Analog.
I met Carmen through my husband because he was one of Carmen's journalism mentors at Boyle Heights Beat, a community news outlet run by high schoolers in the Boyle Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles. Carmen has created her own community radio show and podcast, Queers for the Clout, and now serves as a fellow at CalMatters. And just a note, in the months since this episode was recorded, Carmen actually became a U.S. citizen. I'm Maya Lau, and this is Other People's Pockets, the show where I ask people about their money so the questions we all have about how much other people make and how their finances work can be a little bit less of a mystery. Carmen, welcome to Other People's Pockets.
Hi, I'm super excited to be here and talk with you.
We're going to start with a cold shower. A lot of podcasts have a lightning round at the end, and we're going to do it in the beginning just to be different. Are you ready?
Cool. Yep.
Who are you?
I'm Carmen.
How much money do you make?
Currently $900 a month.
Have you ever talked publicly about your finances before?
Nope.
And how do you feel about talking about your finances and about financial transparency in general?
The word that comes to my mind is icky.
Why do you think, for you and why do you think for other people, it can be so hard to talk about money?
I think, well, at least for me, like, at a very young age, I'm told to not share those things. They're private things that you only share, like, with your parents and, like, with very close family. There's this idea within, like, my family and, like, maybe even my community of, like, you know, not everyone is looking out for you. So maybe sharing how much you earn might, you know, put you to bad standing with the manager or with your employer. This idea of, like, competition is very prevalent.
What socioeconomic class would you consider yourself when you were growing up, and what do you consider yourself now?
Growing up, I would say there's levels to, like, low income. So growing up, I would say I was, like, borderline, like, ooh, like, this might be, you know, charity project for someone. Very poor, I would say that's the way I would describe. And then now I would say low income, hitting maybe, like, the lower part of middle class. But I feel like everyone describes themselves as, like, middle class, but, you know, we're very more comfortable.
Yeah. I would say. Yeah. No, I know. It's so true. Everyone's, like, kind of tends toward saying that they're middle class. Tell me about your upbringing, kind of in general, and also any messages you might have heard about money growing up.
Yeah. Well, growing up, my parents are opposites. My mom is a saver. She's a couponer. She likes, you know, the way we describe it is cheap. And then my dad overspends. So money was always like something that they, like, fought about. So growing up, I was very, like, aware of, oh, they're fighting again because of this or blah, blah, blah. Like, it was always around money. And, like, from a very young age, I knew money was an issue. But the way my dad thinks, my dad grew up a lot poorer than my mom. My mom was actually and they both grew up in Mexico. And my mom grew up a little bit more affluent than my father. But my dad has this mentality of like, even if there's a little bit for us, we still need to share it with everyone, like not just family, but just friends. Like if there's enough for us, there's enough for everyone. So I kind of like, even though I was aware and I knew we weren't rich or even had any economic stability, I knew like we had to share it. Whatever it was, whatever good things we got, it was like for everyone. I would like to say I was the one that got involved. My parents didn't necessarily involve me in it. And, you know, we could have conversation about being the oldest daughter, like being in an immigrant household and what that means. But yeah, I tended to really, I ask a lot of questions, reasons why I'm a journalist. So my mom would answer them and, you know, I would get involved in their financials, maybe when I shouldn't have.
What kind of questions would you ask them?
Well, especially like, well, why did you screw my dad? And, oh, well, because he overspent money that we didn't have. But if he earned that money, shouldn't, like just kind of like trying to understand why there, like what logical reasoning there was to the fight.
Right.
Yeah, because I tend to do that a lot with things. I just, sometimes I don't understand, like, why is that logical for some people?
Right.
And especially when it came to money. Now, as an adult, I understand, like, fundamentally my mom saw money in a different way than my dad saw money.
Mm-hmm.
And now as an adult, I'm able to maybe even help them better communicate about money with each other.
Because right.
The issues are still there.
Right. No, the dynamic doesn't just disappear. Yeah. But you have like a kind of good, not totally outside, but like you have another perspective for them to like to be like a mirror to them. Like,
yeah. And also like, I'm known as an overspender in my family unit. So, like, and I'm not ashamed of it at all. Because I think, you know, we live under capitalism and I'm young. So, thank you. I will spend my money. That's enough. That's enough oppression already. I'm like, I can spend my money. And my mom is, you know, she gives me advice on how to save and she's like, you would have a car by now. And I'm like, public transportation is fine. I'm thriving. But my dad, on the other hand, he sees himself reflected on me. And he's like, yo, you need to, like, stop spending so much. Like,
oh, know. Does he come down even harder on you than your mom?
Oh, don't trigger me with that question. overall, he does. No, yeah, he says he's preparing me for the real world. I don't know what that, I'm like... So you're traumatizing me before. Okay. thanks. He does. He really does. And I kind of understand because his whole life he's struggled with money. So he knows what it is to be a overspender. And he has had to live the overspending life with 3 kids.
Mm-hmm.
And I remind him, I'm like, I don't have kids.
Yeah.
So is it technically overspending? Like, it's just maybe irresponsible spending. So yeah, he does. My dad does tend to go a little harder on me, but I kind of ignore him.
Where did you grow up?
Let's go down this wild journey. I'll take you. So I'll pause in the middle of it so you can take it in. Okay.
Okay. Awesome. I'm here. I'm here for the journey. So.
Yes. So mom was born in San Bernardino, California in 81. And then her sister in 82, they leave in 83 to Mexico, Sinaloa. And that's where my mom grows up for most of her life.
Mm-hmm.
My grandma has more kids there. My dad, whole life, grew up in Mexico, Sinaloa. They meet there. They date there. They fall in love there. Once my mom got pregnant with me, my grandma was like, you should really go to the U.S. You're a citizen. Your kid should be a citizen. And my mom, being a 19-year-old who was scared and pregnant, didn't want to do that because that's a country she didn't know. She didn't know anyone in the U.S. So they decide, my dad decides to move to Tijuana, and my mom follows him. And, you know, in the, you know, the goal was that she was going to cross. She doesn't cross, and she has me in Tijuana. And then we moved to New Mexico. I lived there until my siblings are born, so like around 5 years. And then we moved to Arizona. In Arizona, I start school. The first year of Obama, I was, I believe, in third grade. My dad gets deported to Mexico. And we lived in Mexico for 4-ish years. And then 3-ish, 4-ish years. And then my mom and I and my siblings moved to the to California. And I was in 8th grade, so 2014. We left my dad in Mexico. Now he's here with us. So when they ask me, like, where I grew up, I'm like, all over the place.
Right.
But I tend to say Arizona and Mexico, because those were the, I guess, more formative years.
Yeah. And so your mom is a citizen, and it sounds like your siblings might be citizens, too, of the U.S.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not. I'm currently going through the immigration process, but as we all know, it's a very long and tedious and expensive process. Actually, one of the reasons why we didn't start it sooner was because my mom and the family was never economically stable to be able to do that process. And now we're a little bit better where we can pay lawyers and pay all the applications and stuff.
Just to give people a sense, like, how much money are we talking about does it take to go through that process?
I believe my mom is, I don't know how you explain it in English, but, like, she's paying it by small increments. But so far it's been, like, $12,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which, you know, $12,000, the amount of makeup I could buy with $12,000. And, you know, I mean, we see it as a necessary thing, right? I can get a legal job without, you know, a work permit. So we know it's a necessary thing for me to continue pursuing my career and my education. So my mom doesn't complain so much about the price tag, but it is hefty.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
You mentioned the, like, gymnastics you have to do with looking for a job with undocumented status. Talk about that more. I mean, how does that affect, like, the types of jobs that you go after?
It really messes with your brain, in the way of how much I see myself valued in.
Mm-hmm.
My first kind of job was Boyle Heights Beat, and they paid me through gift cards. And you can't really do much with gift cards. Mm-hmm.
And that, like, they had to because, like, legally they couldn't actually give you cash.
Yeah, or I couldn't be on the payroll. Like, I didn't have anything, like, no social security number to be on the payroll.
Right.
So that was the first time where I was handing a little bit more money. And it was for me, and I was like, wow, okay, like, if I wanted to buy something over the card amount, I couldn't combine all the cards. So
right. And it was gift cards to where?
It was like Visa gift cards. So I could technically like, it was kind of like a debit card.
Oh, okay. So you could spend it anywhere that they take Visa, but it was, yeah, but you couldn't combine them and yeah.
Yeah. So when I wanted to splurge on my makeup, which is what I spend the most on, I there was a limit. I had to do it like in a couple orders because I couldn't like combine the cards.
Right.
So that was kind of my first introduction into like, okay, so this is what kind of working as an undocumented student looks like. I hit college and I was like, okay, like I'm not, California is a great state for undocumented students. So I wasn't paying a lot of money out of pocket, but I also wasn't pocketing any money. So I don't get right. refund checks.
Right.
I don't get money from the federal government. So I was going to school in zeros, basically, like compared to like my friends who would, you know, it would hit October and they would get their refund checks and they had a little bit more money to spend. I was going like completely zeros. Like I wasn't paying the school because California has grants and stuff, but I also wasn't pocketing any money. So,
mm-hmm.
And then the other instance where I realized how difficult it was I joined a fellowship with UCLA Labor Center, their Dream Center, a fellowship specifically for undocumented students. And while I was doing that fellowship over the summer, I met another fellow who was like in their late 20s. And I was like, oh my God, like, wow, you must be like a grad student. Like you're a little bit older than what I'm used to as a college student. And they actually shared that they continue to be in school because that's the only way they can work. Because sometimes, because internships and fellowships are open, sometimes if you're a student, they're a little more like flexible with how they pay and they stipend and stuff like that. And it shocked me because I was like, that's kind of what I'm doing. Like if I had papers, if I would even do school as an undocumented student, like school is very much valued and it gives you worth.
Right. And then it's like, if you're not in school, then you're not looked at as, yeah, that you're not as valuable or like your potential is different or something. You know, in a capitalist system, in an immigration landscape that doesn't actually reward people for what they're actually worth, like, how do you view that? Because I know that what we get paid or what the jobs that are offered to us, like, of course, they don't necessarily reflect what we're worth. But at the same time, it can feel like it has an impact on your self-worth. Like, so I'm just curious how you view that.
Yeah, I think I, even with all my identities and all the systems in place that make living as Carmen difficult, I tend to say I'm a very privileged person. Because I have the knowledge that these systems are in place to make it difficult. So I really don't have any of that guilt or any of that, maybe I should have a little more guilt, but like any of that shame. I didn't grow up religious, so I don't have that religious shame. My parents always told me to like, ask questions, even to authority figures, which they later regretted because I was asking them too many questions. They always said, you know, that I don't necessarily have to respect people just because they respect me, because sometimes mean people are passive aggressive. Mm-hmm. And I took these things really to heart. So when I entered the workforce or somewhat of the workforce, I really was like, you know, like I'm not making enough. That's very clear to me. And it's not because I'm not capable and it's not because I'm not worthy or I don't have the skill sets, but I'm not getting paid enough because there's some white man as a CEO who thinks I'm not worthy enough. And for that, I'm like, that's not my problem. Like, I'm not going to feel that shame that sometimes, like, capitalism wants you to carry that weight. And I'm like, I'm already carrying everyone else's weight. I don't need capitalism's too. So I tend to not But it does, some days it does get heavy. And on those days, I'm like, damn, you've lived in another country. I only have 9 years here. Like, there's so much I've already done. So, you know, I try to, like, not think about it as much. And maybe that's, like, an immigrant mentality of, like, don't think too much because then panic starts setting in. but, yeah, that's the way I would answer that question. I think the way I deal with it is, like, I put the blame on someone else, mm-hmm. on a bigger power,
yeah,
not
yeah.
myself.
I mean, it sounds like you've always been a question asker and always liked to question authority. Is that what got you into journalism?
Yeah, I think I started out as a student activist, and I realized that it was very tiring, and if, you know, I wasn't earning anything at that time, but it demanded so much of my time. Mm-hmm. And I always liked writing, so I was like, huh, maybe I can spotlight these communities that are struggling in a different way. And then I joined Boyle Heights Beat, and with them, I realized that there was so many other issues within the Boyle Heights community, within LA city. And I was like, huh, maybe I'll stick around a little bit. And then somehow I got sucked into radio and I fell in love with it. And that's kind of, I don't know, it was a natural kind of progression. My parents thought I was going to be a lawyer. Law school is not happening for me ever. but once that, like, they realized that I was very serious about this career, they were like, yeah, it makes sense. They never questioned it. They were like, yeah, that's where she should be.
That I love that. Yeah, my mom always used to say that she thought I would become a lawyer just because of my, like, argumentative ways and, like, logic bullying ways. And I probably didn't realize that, like, journalism is also an outlet for that. So I relate to that.
And it's also a lot cheaper. I'm like, are y'all really willing to put me through law school? I don't think so.
Going back to Boyle Heights Beat for a second, describe a little bit more about what it is, who does it, what it's for, because it's a very cool program.
Yeah, so Boyle Heights Beat is a hyperlocal news publication, and they recruit students in the Boyle Heights area of Los Angeles. It's pretty cool because recently they had, like, homeschooled students, they had charter kids, they, you know, a mix of all the kids in the community, and they get to report on the community, about the community, and I was part of Boyle Heights Beat from 2017 to 2019 as a youth reporter. And then when I went off to college, I was doing on and off kind of gigs for them. And now I'm back as staff, as their, like, a community outreach coordinator. And yeah, they're like a staple in the Boyle Heights community for all Boyle Heights news and also, like, Los Angeles City news.
Yeah, and it's cool because it's not just, like, news for high schoolers. It's news for the community, like, adults and everybody, but the reporters are youth reporters. And there's, like, a newspaper element. There's, like, a live radio show element.
I've done stories on TPS, stories on gentrification. I've also had the opportunity through Boyle Heights Beat when I was in high school to do, like, play reviews, which is, like, I think, not something I do now, but it's such a cool experience to have. And, you know, a lot of people join Boyle Heights Beat with, you know, it's an internship for high school students. You'll get paid for each article. Ooh, cool. But you honestly leave with, like, this huge network, a better idea of what the community truly is. And also, like, it really sets you up for college in a way that I don't think regular schmegular, like, K through 12 does. It makes you just think critically of the world, of society, of your own community. And Boyle Heights Beat always encouraged its reporters, you know, no one gets to talk about Boyle Heights like it's high school students. Like, they know their community. They know all the drug dealers, but they also know all the popping places. Like, no, like, LA Times reporter will ever be able to cover Boyle Heights like its reporters, so...
So how would you define your style of journalism and what's your kind of ultimate goal in the field?
I don't know. I think the way I see my journalism is what community is not being talked about in a holistic way. Mm-hmm. And I, like recently, I am a CalMatters fellow. Mm-hmm. And my first story with them was a story on how undocumented students, we're entering an era where most DACA students are full-on adults with kids. So the undocumented students, the new undocumented student generation that's entering college doesn't have protections, mm-hmm. and they can't work. So how are they paying for college? Mm-hmm. Especially like the bigger UCs here in California. So I got to cover legislation that recently passed to ensure there's like fellowships and internships specifically for undocumented students in California. And I talk about that story because I think that's what my journalism is about, is there's always issues within minoritized communities. Like with undocumented people, you know, they always tend to talk about the emotional and like the just the hardships of being undocumented in the U.S. But we rarely talk about how hard it is to live like financially as an undocumented person. Mm-hmm. People are afraid to talk about those things. There's plenty of reasons why people are afraid. But I also think if we don't speak up on it, there's really no one's going to pay attention and try to find a solution. So that's kind of the purpose of my journalism is to highlight issues that aren't highlighted and just get it out there. Like, you know, there's stuff that like disabled students like live through in college and no one really talks about that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. That's kind of how I would describe it. And I think my long-term goal in the career is to, I don't know. I think, I would love to be able to do more like fun reporting in the sense of, I hope I get to a point where I'm not needed anymore. And my perspective and my point of view is not needed. 'Cause I'm okay with that. I'm okay with not being needed. So I think I would love to do some food blogging. I don't know. I think that's something I haven't tried. I haven't tried sports reporting either, but I'm okay with not trying that. That's hardcore. I'm not that hardcore.
Yeah, they have to put out stuff fast. Like, I don't know how they do that.
Yeah, and then honestly, the way my brain works, I'm like, let's talk about the issues here. The societal issues that happen because of sports.
Wait, but you could be like a commentator, like, you know, like the live commentators, and then they have like the quote unquote color commentary where they're like filling in like, oh, well, you know, back in 94, blah, blah, blah. Like, I feel like you could be like a color commentator for sports about like the things that you want to talk about, you know, but without having to do like, this is the score. Like, but you could talk about like the other stuff that's interesting. I actually feel like that would be really cool.
Yeah, like this player was accused of domestic violence.
Yeah,
and
or
so
like
was this one.
For you, like, as you think about the kind of life you want, the kind of career you want, how do you think about money and like the kind of money you want to make? And I don't know, how do you think about all that at this point in your life?
My dad would say I don't think about it that much. I love school and I love learning. So I would like to continue onto my master's and hopefully PhD. That's kind of the mentality I have right now. And I also know that, like, you know, for a PhD or a doctorate, that very much sometimes means, like, staying in academia. And you don't really earn a lot as a college professor or as a researcher. So I know, I don't know, like, I know the life that awaits me. But also, like, I don't know, this might be TMI or not, but I really don't care. Like,
I don't care either.
I'm like, oh, I already, like, trauma dumped, and I'm like, oh, this might be TMI. I don't want kids. So I know, I'm very much, like, the goals I have and the path I'm taking is very much with that idea. Like, I don't want kids. I actually never really wanted kids. I told my mom since I was, like 8 years old, I was like, I'm not a motherly figure. Like, that's not my thing. I want to, like, learn and meet the world. Like, I want to spend a long time doing that. And now they're like, okay, that's fine. We'll be, you know, grandparents to dogs and cats. And they're happy with that. My sister is on the same boat. And we're both, she takes photos. She's a photographer. She's younger than me. So our dream has been to, like, create a magazine where I write.
Cool.
And she, like,
that's awesome.
Takes photos. So maybe that will be in the plans.
Yeah.
Like, I'm very much, like, I love creating things. So I see myself doing that. And I don't know. You don't really earn a lot of money. So I'm very, like, aware that I'm going into this with not earning a lot of money when you, like, create things and, like, try new things. So I'm very aware of the lifestyle I might have.
I think that's a good place to be in as a creative person. Like, I think that sets you up to be, like, resourceful and surprise yourself.
Yeah, and I think I'm in a very lucky position where my parents said they'll support me as I continue my education journey. So I'm really taking this time to, like, create and fail and do things and try things, because they'll support me with rent and transportation. So
that's awesome. Your parents sound really cool. Because there's a lot of parents who might be like, oh, I don't want you to go into journalism. Like, you need to go into engineering or whatever, something that'll make more money. And I think it sounds like your parents, like, get you and are like, yeah, we support you.
Yeah, well, I mean, both of my parents are very creative people, too. So I was like, where do you think you were going to get a doctor? Like, that doesn't make sense.
You know, that's not happening, right?
Yeah. I was like, no. My brother started high school, and we saw that he thrived in history and English. And I was like, there. He's the youngest. And I was like, there. Your potential of having a doctor in the family, like a medical doctor, is gone. I was like, we're all humanities. Yeah. We're all readers. You're screwed.
You mentioned earlier, like, the concept, like, your dad, I think your dad had, you said, like, about, like, if we have some, then there's enough for all of us, and there's enough for, like, the family, and I don't know if you meant also, like, the community or neighbors or relatives. Can you talk about, like, your perspective on shared resources and community, and, like, also as you go forward, like, is your money for the group? Is it for you? Is there a different, like... Yeah, I'd love your thoughts on that.
Yeah, when I moved to the U.S., to California in 2014, I joined, like, a lot of advocacy groups that worked on, like, having more inclusive curriculum in LUSD schools. And a lot of Black feminists kind of took me under their wings and really taught me, like, just not, like, kind of the ropes of what it is to be American and, like, to live in America, but also, like, concepts of community care. Mm-hmm. And one of them, something they repeated a lot was, like, you know, there's this Asada Shakur chant of, like, damn, I don't remember specifically, but it's something about, like, we have nothing to lose but these chains. Mm-hmm. And we chanted that a lot as a group. And I don't know what's up with me that I take sometimes these phrases to heart, and I really truly believe them. But I really live by that. Like, there's nothing. What else do we have to lose? And that community care, that community love, that community aspect really informed the way I, like, went through life and my teenage years. And there was also this idea, which I had already seen with my dad, but they kind of conceptualized it and, you know, put theory and all this behind it. But, you know, this idea of, like, no one's free until everyone's free.
Mm-hmm.
Until the most oppressed group is free, no one else will be free. And that kind of really connects to what my dad's idea of, if there's for us, there's for everyone. And for me, it was just such a natural thing to believe in and to do. I think capitalism makes us tired and makes us cranky and makes us think that, you know, we're the only ones struggling with whatever we're struggling with.
And makes us want to, like, only look out for ourselves. Like, well, I got to, you know, hoard my money because otherwise, like, how will I have enough to buy XYZ? Like, yeah.
Yeah, and my mom really thinks like that. And actually, we've been working on dismantling that idea with her because it doesn't do anyone good other than the people in power. Now that I, like, earn my money, which is not a lot, but that is truly just mine. My parents don't ask for any of it. I also spend it with that idea. I'm like, okay, so I'm going to order something from Amazon Prime. Who needs something?
It's not just your cart. It's like, yeah. Hey, while I put together this order, like, does anyone want to add something?
So yeah. my debit card is known as, like, the family card. Like, if there's money on it, anyone can spend from it. Like, I genuinely don't, like, I don't check in with me. I don't care. Like, because also my siblings and my parents do a lot. Like, they adjust their schedules to me recording, to my interviews. You know, my dad takes me sometimes to interviews and to gigs and stuff like that. So I'm like, I'm not necessarily going to put you on a salary. But, like, you know, I can, yeah. You know, I'll buy dinner or, hey, let's go try this place. Like, yeah.
You've mentioned a few times your Amazon cart, and we do have another segment we do sometimes called Cart to Cart. And so it's basically like, we all tend to have things in, like, lingering in our online shopping carts that we just haven't, like, clicked purchase yet. Do you have anything that's, like, sitting in your online carts that's like that?
Yes. Okay. On my Sephora app.
Okay.
I have the Dior Backstage Rosy Glow Blush, and then Dior. And then I have this really expensive perfume that I know for a fact I'm not buying, but I know it smells good, so I'm going to find a dupe for it that's cheaper.
Yeah.
And then a lot of Fenty by Rihanna.
Mm-hmm.
And then a lot of Rare by Selena Gomez. That comes. The total's like, oh, that's out of stock. I'm so sad. It's above like 200.
Mm-hmm. Carmen, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Other People's Pockets is written and hosted by me, Maya Lau. It's produced by me along with Joy Sanford and Dan Gallucci. Production help from Angela Vang. Our executive producers are me, along with Jane Marie and Dan Gallucci. A special thanks to Communal Amazon Carts. Other People's Pockets is a co-production of Pushkin Industries and Little Everywhere. To find more Pushkin podcasts, listen on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to HarlemGlobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.